Hello, everyone. This is the Stark Truth on Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Robert Stark. My guest for today is Al Bartlett. He's a professor of emeritus physics at the University of Colorado at Boulder. It's nice having you on the show.
Well, thank you. I'm very pleased to be with you.
So your area of expertise, sort of what you focus on, is the issues having to do with overpopulation.
That is correct. I've done that in recent years. I've became very interested. In fact, it was 43 years ago yesterday that I first gave a talk on this subject, and I've developed the talk and given it now something like 1,732 times since then, all over the world. On growth, the problems of growth, the arithmetic of growth, and overpopulation.
So what brought your attention to this issue?
Well, I realized that years ago that a lot of people had no idea of the arithmetic of compound interest on money in the bank. And that's the same, you know, if you have your savings account growing 5% per year, the numbers are the same as though you had a population growing 5% per year, and people didn't understand the arithmetic and the enormously big numbers you get if you have just a modest period of growth with modest rate of growth. So so I tried to start out to educate people to understand the big numbers and to see how you can calculate them in your head approximately. Very easily.
Was part of it, I know you were involved in the conservation movement in Boulder and dealing with the issue of overdevelopment there. Was that a big part of it?
That started earlier, and I was involved here in originally in 1959 in the Blue Line, which was an amendment to the city charter to prevent the city from serving city water west of a north-south line. We drew at the west side of the town. We didn't want houses up in the foothills and the city paying expensive pumps to pump water up to the houses. And so that started it. And in 1967, we had an election for sales tax increase, and the part of the increase would go to buy open space lands. And so since that 1967 election, we've purchased something like 50,000 acres of mountain foothills and space around the eastern part of the town. And that space is now all in public ownership, and some of it is used for agriculture, but much of it's used for recreation.
In comparison to other cities, Colorado and other parts of the country, would you say that has had a stronger impact and it has slowed down the new growth compared to other places?
Well, I'm not aware of very many places that have passed a tax to buy open space land. That's a rather rare thing, I think, but it ought to be much more common.
So Boulder has still grown a lot despite that?
Boulder's grown a lot even though we passed an ordinance voted by the people some years ago to limit the growth to 2% per year. Well, 2% is a disaster. It's so high. But that's better than the 6% growth we'd had from 1950 to 1970. And since then, the council has lowered the growth rate to something like 1%, but we're still growing 1% per year, and you have people in the city council talking about, oh, we've got to work on sustainability. And I tell them, I write to them, I say, you know, the first law of sustainability is you cannot sustain population growth, and you cannot sustain growth in the rates of consumption of resources. But they just go on blithely improving new apartments and new shopping centers and new subdivisions as though there'll be infinite resources to supply these. And it's clear that they worry about water. They ask us to use less water, each of the present customers, but then they go ahead and bring new customers online. It's crazy.
And is there sort of this debate? You sort of, well, you say that sustainable growth is an oxymoron. A lot of
yes.
A lot of people say that. You do hear a lot of people saying that the solution to these problems is increasing density.
Well, that's right. Those are simply short-term things designed to. It's like giving aspirin for cancer. Slightly alleviate the symptoms, but don't worry about the main cause of the problem.
And with these politicians, what do you see as a stronger political reason for, well, look at those, I mean, especially the politicians who are pro-growth, do you think it's more that they want the increased tax revenue or it's the campaign funds from the developers?
Well, the developers are very well-to-do, and they contribute a lot of campaign money, and the cities get more taxes from the growth. But the problem is that the growth requires more expenditures of tax funds for municipal things like police, fire, school systems, and streets and everything. And the expenses rise faster than the income does from taxes. So the bottom line is that this urban growth never, and I repeat that, never pays for itself. And yet, people know this, and yet they just go on going, plugging for growth all the time.
And growth, I mean, growth in general, but definitely with the more spread out the growth is, also the more costlier it is, because you have to pay for greater, over a larger area, there's going to be more roads and more services, like for police and firefighters.
Yeah, and the other extreme is to make it very dense like New York City. And I'm glad there's some people like to live in New York City. I don't, so they're totally dependent on their utilities. I just saw a thing in the New York Times of a new apartment tower in New York City at the south end of Central Park that's rising to something like 100 stories. So it's tall, almost like the Empire State Building. And some of these apartments go, which occupy a whole floor, so the owner has a views out for all four sides, go for $80 million or dollars, some enormous sum like that, and they're selling them. The people are so rich that some people can buy those. But that's the other extreme, and they are totally dependent on utilities, electricity. If their electricity goes out, what are they going to do, walk down 85 floors?
I mean, what you're saying is it's fine. It's for people who want that. It's fine to have places like that, but it's not a permanent. It's not a permanent solution to this problem without addressing the growth.
Absolutely.
And the big issue with the growth, most of the growth is caused by immigration, and that's also a lot of people don't want to address that. Even the conservatives. Who say, they'll say that they're against illegal immigration because it's illegal, but no one wants to tackle the growth issue having to do with immigration.
Right, and most of the immigration into the U.S. is legal. There is illegal immigration that makes the news, but the two political parties in Washington compete with each other to see who can pass bills to allow the largest number of legal immigrants in.
Exactly. I mean, Mitt Romney was saying that he was saying that in a speech that we need to make it more difficult to come here illegally, but we need to make it easier to come here legally.
Yeah.
And what do you see as the major reasons why there's not any opposition to that? It's probably a lot of it's not politically correct, but the interest groups that you've talked about, they obviously want the cheap labor, so it's both.
Right. The business people want the cheap labor and they want the customers. And so they keep thinking they can have more customers, more cheap labor with immigration. And there's another law of sustainability is that any country that has to import people to do the work of the country is unsustainable. You cannot sustain a country for long periods of time by importing people to do the work of the country.
Well, the thing is that, yeah, exactly. People say that that Americans don't want to do those jobs, but we have a massive unemployment rate. It's just that the corporate interest, they want to keep the wages low.
Yes.
And they want to increase. The other thing is not just the keeping the wages low, they also want a larger consumer base.
Yeah, right, more customers to buy their products. And they assume that there will always be sufficient resources to produce and manufacture all the stuff they make that they want to sell. And we're beginning to run out of some of those resources. I've seen recently some pictures of new mines in Mongolia where they're displacing the native people. And these mines are very rich in copper and gold. And so big international companies are going into outer Mongolia to develop these mines just so they can get the minerals out and so that people can continue to manufacture goods for sale to people. And so we're upsetting a whole way of life over there.
And the thing is that a lot of the politically correct environmentalists, or I should say so-called environmentalists, they'll defend the mass immigration by saying that we should just look at the population issue on a global level. But by coming to this country, they're dramatically increasing their footprint on the environment by adopting our standard of living.
That is correct.
And the other issue of population that you focus on, and this is not something that's brought up, I think you're one of the few people who bring this up, is how overpopulation affects democracy.
Yes. When I moved to the Boulder, Colorado, in the year 1950, the population of Boulder was 20,000, and there were 9 members of the city council. Today, the population is 5 times as large. It's 100,000, and there are still just 9 members of the city council. So we only have 1/5 of the democracy that we had in 1950. We have 5 times as many people in Boulder per member of the city council as we had years ago. And the same thing is true on the national level. Between 1990 and 2000, the United States population increased by 13.1%. But the number of representatives in the U.S. House of Representatives didn't change. It stayed at 435 members. And so this means then that the democracy in the United States in that 10-year period declined by 13.1%. Now you have to translate that into, well, how many people does that mean? And it turns out that in 1990, every congressional district had approximately 600,000 people in it, every congressional district across the United States. After the redistricting in the year 2000, that had to increase by 13.1% in every district. So that means every district had approximately 100,000 additional constituents, up to 700,000. Well, now you couldn't, as one person, a representative, you couldn't represent 100,000 people, let alone 600,000 or 700,000. So it's much easier for the people in Washington to represent the lobbyists because the lobbyists have got the money. And there are only a few hundred lobbyists for every member of Congress. So this means then it's much easier to represent the lobbyists than it is to represent the people.
And what do you see as solutions to this?
Well, I think the first thing we ought to do is to get overpopulation back on the national agenda so people are talking about it. And then I think we have to make sure that family planning assistance is available worldwide at no cost to every couple that requests it, with the goal being that every child should be a wanted child.
And with the issue of democracy, is the population issue is critical, but what about, do you think having smaller jurisdictions or increasing, having maybe smaller congressional districts is a solution?
Well, smaller districts mean that there have to be more of them. So instead of 435, you'd have to have a larger number. You know, if you double that, it might be like almost 900 congressional districts. Well, that becomes unworkable. It's too many. The size of the House of Representatives would be just too large to be manageable. Today, it's hard to manage.
So you don't really, other than the population issue, there isn't really a way to tackle that problem.
Well, the population problem has to be addressed. At some point, we'll realize this. And, you know, a lot of people very concerned about global warming. Well, global warming, the primary cause of global warming is overpopulation. But the people who talk about it professionally, experts who go around the country lecturing on global warming, all they talk about is being more efficient, using more efficient light bulbs and more efficient automobiles and so on. And they never talk about reducing overpopulation.
And it's the exact same thing with the energy debate. There's this whole debate about whether we should drill for oil or not, but
yes. It
ignores the population issue of that completely.
Yes. Yeah, all this pressure to drill, baby, drill, that's just driven by overpopulation. And people say, oh, well, you know, the new technologies let us get more oil out of the ground, and that's true. They let us use it up faster. We get it faster, we'll use it up faster.
So you have a book called The Essential Exponential.
Yes. Yeah, that's a reprint book, a collection of a number of articles I've written on this over time. And I have a website. It's albartlett.org. And a lot of the papers from that book are on the website.
So, you have your different articles on there. So you talk about the energy crisis, it's called The Forgotten Fundamentals of the Energy
Yes.
Crisis. And these are, a lot of these articles, some of them go back to, this one's from 1978.
Yes. Yeah, I've been concerned about this many years.
And was that any connection between there was an energy crisis in the 70s. Is that what inspired that article?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Was the oil crisis in the 70s what inspired that article?
Well, that helped, yes. Yeah, that was when the OPEC countries put on an embargo and shut down production because they didn't like us. And this produced a lot of hardship in this country. And, you know, there were long lines of cars at the gas stations, and the gas stations ran out of gas, and people were angry and upset and couldn't get to work and so on. It was a very difficult time.
Now, on the democracy thing, you have a chapter. The chapter is, and this one's from 2000, is democracy cannot survive overpopulation.
That's a quote from Isaac Asimov. He tells about how if you have two people in an apartment and there are two bathrooms, then both people have complete freedom in the bathroom. Either one can go to the bathroom anytime they want, stay as long as they want, no problem. But if you put 20 people in the apartment and there are only two bathrooms, then no one has freedom in the bathroom. And you've got to ration out the time in the bathroom for each people. Each person has to take his turn using the bathroom. And so he says in the same way, democracy cannot survive overpopulation.
And that's a good point, because I think it relates to people more when you make it more personal. Like if you make it about their personal apartment, than they really think about
yes.
it. Well, when you talk about it on a larger level, it's sometimes maybe too abstract to people.
Yes.
So you said there that there's sort of the article is called The Massive Movement to Marginalize the Modern Malthusian Message. And that Malthus
yes.
was the one, the first one to talk about the population issue. But who can you give some examples of how there is a movement to try to marginalize that message?
Well, you talk to most economists and they say, oh, well, we've proven Malthus is wrong. Well, I've read Malthus 3 times. He understood the problem. He was right. But still, these people say, oh, well, with modern technology, we've proven Malthus wrong. That's nuttier than a fruitcake.
And what goes back to what we were talking about earlier, but they seem, their motivation is like they're actively trying to suppress any discussion of this. Because, and a lot of it, I think, goes even further beyond, I talked about the special interests that are lobbying. Also, I mean, our economic system is based on growth.
That's right. The economic system is based on growth. And anything that's based on growth has a lot in common with a Ponzi scheme. And that means that it'll grow until something stops the growth, and then it falls apart. And we saw a big falling apart here in the year 2008 because our economy had grown so fast with all kinds of people promoting the growth, and with the government at the request of these people, the Congress had removed the restrictions that would have protected us. The Congress repealed the Glass-Steagall Act from the Depression era, and that was designed to stop all this growth and the speculation that led to the big breakdown of the society. And so now they've tried to put some of those restrictions back in, but the bankers and the business people all fight against it and say, no, that's against the free economy. Well, a free economy got us. A free economy is what's promoting this Ponzi scheme, and this Ponzi scheme's always collapse.
I know there's a movement that has a website. They're called Steady State Economics, and they're about kind of coming up with a solution to growth-based economics. But the dilemma you get is if prosperity is based on growth, it's sort of coming up. I mean, I'm not an economist. But the whole dilemma is coming up with a solution where you're able to preserve prosperity without which is not based on growth, and that's sort of the whole dilemma.
That's it. And the growth is based on resources, and the critical resource we can see it starting to come up short is petroleum. And petroleum is necessary for the growth they're talking about. And we can see that production of petroleum has flattened out, and the predictions are that we may have already passed the peak of petroleum production worldwide.
So what do you see happening when there's eventually it is probably just going to run out, but we're probably going to see a massive scarcity in maybe 30 years from now?
I think we'll see scarcity probably before that, of petroleum.
And could it lead to, what do you see happening? Do you see a major economic, just a major kind of global economic collapse? And the other factor
yeah.
is you see rising economies like China that are going to, they're going to have a strong, they're growing, their demand for oil is growing as well.
Yes. Right now, China is increasing its demand for oil. India is increasing its demand. Ours is not increasing very much at the present time. But China and India and Indonesia and other places like this, they're all increasing their demand for oil. And it's predicted now, I've seen predictions, that within about another 10 or 15 years or so, that Saudi Arabia will become a net importer of oil. provided there's somewhere that'll supply the oil. But all these countries are going after, China in particular, is going all over the world. They're buying up oil properties. You can see the news, they're fighting over these little islands in the South China Sea because it's claimed that there may be oil in the sea bottom near there, and the Chinese want it. The Chinese are buying up oil properties in Africa and all over the world and getting all the oil they can, and making treaties with Venezuela to get oil from Venezuela. It's pretty amazing.
And what are your thoughts on the viability of alternative energy sources?
Well, there aren't very many. There's no real alternative to gasoline for propelling vehicles. Electricity, well, you know, it's very, very limited. The batteries are heavy and they don't have much capacity. Even the best batteries that people can buy with all the years of research in battery chemistry and so on, batteries are still not very satisfactory. So there isn't any real substitute for petroleum.
And with the growth issue, what's interesting is what I see happening is as oil, petroleum becomes scarce, people won't be able to drive as much. So it will, in a sense, it will kind of force us to, well, it will cause a lot of hardships in the future, but it will sort of force us to slow down growth. And I mean, you'll see people being able to live in the whole sort of the move to the suburbs was a product of the automobile, and that won't, it will sort of, what will happen is it will slow down growth and people won't be able to live further distances. It will also kind of force people into density at the same time.
That's correct. Yeah. Our whole urban society is based on petroleum. And when petroleum production peaks, that will be followed by peak everything. Our whole agriculture system is based on petroleum. When petroleum peaks, agricultural production will peak. Airline travel will peak. Automobile travel will peak. A lot of manufacturing will peak because it's dependent on petroleum. I mean, the ramifications for our society are simply staggering.
And you say that regional planning will make the problem worse. Give some examples.
Yes.
Of what do you mean by region-wide planning?
Well, you see, with air pollution, they talk about, well, it's a regional problem. It isn't a problem just for Boulder. We're in the Denver metropolitan area, and so it's a problem that has to be solved in the whole area. Well, that's in a sense true. But what you have is, in Boulder, I'm 1 in 100,000, so I can have some little say in what Boulder does about air pollution. But in the Denver area, where there are 2 or 3 million people, I'm only 1 in 2 or 3 million, so I don't have much say in terms of what the Denver area does. And so, but the real problem is that urban planning, as it's actually practiced, is designed to make the system worse. And here's the way that works. Urban planners are trained to solve problems. Now, what's a problem? A problem is anything that limits population growth. You know, we don't have enough capacity in the sewer system, so we build a larger sewer system. We don't have enough water supply, so we build a larger water supply. We don't have enough street capacity for our vehicles, so we build bigger streets. So all of these are solving the problems, are reducing the things that inhibit population growth. So this means then that population growth can proceed. And so population growth is making the problems worse. So everything the planners do tends to make the problems worse.
And you write a lot of your, I mean, you were a professor in physics and...
Yes.
A lot of your articles were published in the American Journal of Physics. How does physics relate to all these issues?
Well, it's through the mathematics. It's sort of physics applied to some real world problems.
And you have a chapter on the arithmetic of growth.
Yes.
Methods of calculation.
I did that for a social science journal, and the editor, I talked to the editor, and I realized that the editor didn't understand some of this important arithmetic, so I asked, would you like me to write a tutorial for your readers on this elementary arithmetic? And the editor said yes, so that article on the arithmetic of growth was done sort of as a tutorial to try to reach some of the social scientists and help them understand this important arithmetic.
And what is the exponential function?
Well, the exponential function is the mathematical function that you would write down to describe the growth. If you want to say if a population is growing 5% per year, well, how big will it be in 30 years? Well, you use the exponential function to calculate that. And so that it's the function that describes steady growth.
So I've covered most of this. Is there anything else you'd like to add that you see as critical to these issues having to do with population?
I don't think so, thank you. It's the worst problem we face, and we've got to get it on the table and get it out where people are discussing it and discussing, well, what do we do about it? And our options are limited, but there are things we can do and we must do in order to solve the problem.
And I just want to plug your website one more time. That was Al Bartlett, Emeritus Professor from University of Colorado Boulder, and the website is albartlett.org. I'd like to thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, Robert.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.